You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
Hi, this is Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. I'm here today with Michel Ratiolet, the author of Even Now, a first novel from Farah Strauss and Giroux. She teaches writing at the University of Irvine, and I thought we'd talk both about writing in general and the writing of a first novel and being a California novelist and all the many things that you can talk about. But to begin with, you know, Even Now is a novel about a young woman whose parents divorce at age 16. At age 10 they divorce, and most of the novel takes place when she's 16 years old. And while the emotional atmosphere is very particular to this young woman, Lisa, there is, it seemed to me, a Southern Californian quality of quiet, of, how to put it, acquiescence that I don't think of in other novels about growing up. Is there something that you might say about that?
That's particularly Southern Californian?
Because
I'm Northern Californian, I guess.
Californian.
No, that's all right. I just tend to make the distinction. That's interesting. Are we maybe most familiar with reading books about boys?
That could be.
And so the acquiescence is not there. And I think this is, you know, not to make statements about gender that are damaging, but I mean, I think that this is a story of a girl, you know, and I don't think she's real forceful. I don't think she's real assertive. I mean, she's trying to keep everybody happy, you know, and that's, it's not that that's the way she hits upon, it's just that she's sort of silent until she figures out some way of acting, you know. So I don't know whether that's California necessarily.
Well, Edmund White, in an essay on California, comments at one point that he thinks that there is no reading the character of Californians in the course of a conversation. That you have, he says, what you think is the beginning of a friendship, and then never see the person with whom you felt socially very intimate ever again, despite protestations of we'll see each other soon and all of the rest of it. And that swallowing of the will, which characterizes this heroine certainly, does seem to me that the feeling that if one announced one's true desires, if one retreated from victimization, that one would be ill-mannered. Having come here 11 years ago as an Easterner, I know I observed it and didn't understand it then. Now feeling a bit more at ease with it, I certainly see it as something that is almost a part of the landscape.
I don't know. Those seem to me very, very adult sentiments, actually, and very, very much adult concerns. And I would say that the character in the book is that... That's not why she's acquiescing. That's not why she's collapsed down into her world at all, unless you put the parents in standing in as you know, allegorical figures for an overstimulated society or something. You know, I don't really see how those perceptions can work with the book. You see what I mean? I mean, I think her acquiescence and her closing herself down, her sort of implosion is not. Is not because of insincerity or of,
oh, no.
I don't really know. I guess I can't get my mind around this question, I guess, in some ways.
I think, if anything, the question is about that fear of displaying an authentic self, and a kind of, maybe more than any other part of the country, and I'm sorry to have inadvertently put you into this geographical idiocy.
Well, no, I mean, It is interesting because, I mean, my sister lives in New York, and so I go to visit them in New York, and I always feel much happier in New York, and I always feel much happier in San Francisco, though, too, because both of those are big cities in which I can talk as loud as I want to in, and I can and you could say funny things, and people understand you and laugh, you know. And in Southern California, I'd say that if you do act out even a little, you get looked at, and that people do prefer to close you down, and maybe that's this is a car culture, and people are used to closing themselves down into their little metal boxes, you know. I don't know. But
it's a very peculiar kind of book, speaking about the car culture, because in a certain way, the narrator of this book, Lisa, is always thinking about being enclosed.
Yes.
At one point, she thinks of being in a car as being not different from being in an elevator, of being in an elevator as not different from being closed in a fist,
right.
Of being carried in her mother's womb the way she's carried in a car, and of being carried by life the way a circus performer is carried by her horse. This is to suggest that this is a book that has a poetically dense chain of metaphor running through it, and it leads to the feeling of great interiority and silence, muteness,
yeah.
on the part of the character, who's frequently aware that she could not possibly speak enough to make available to others the feelings that she has.
Yeah.
This kind of novel, do you think one, in order to write this kind of novel, one must, as you are, one must first be a poet?
Okay, well I want to go back. Three things. You're such a beautiful reader. Thank you. To have somebody just reel off a series of images. Thank you. That's amazing. But also I want to make the distinction between adult and child. The car... in the book is an incarcerating thing, and I think the car in Southern California is protection. It's finally you get away from the hordes, and I think one's adult, you have independence, you can go buy this thing that you can close yourself up in and be alone in and rest in, right? And here's a child that is incarcerated in the car with screaming parents, you know, and then the car becomes a prison, you know, and so there's a That's why where the differences come in on that, and on the being a poet. I mean, I'm not sure I am a poet, you know, at all. I mean, I mean, I've just been reading some of Louise Gluck and Moore and Bishop, and I mean, those are poets. You know, I'm not a poet. I mean, those are poets. I love what poetry can do, and I love the denseness and the lushness and the images, and which seem to me most akin to what our minds are. When something hits us, it's just not that little thing hitting us. It's a stream of things, and I tend to like to recapture with the stimulus of one thing the hundreds of other things that come with it, whether they're completely off the wall or not. I like minimalism, but it's that idea that life is so reduced down that it becomes suggestive. Well, that's very interesting, and I like that. But what I like to suggest by one bit of action is the tremendous background of memory that comes with it. So,
Coleridge points out that a tendency toward metaphor in response to an experience is often a function of fear.
Right.
That metaphor comes to mind when one cannot bring oneself to experience directly the thing that you witness. Now, since this book is very unusually and beautifully metaphoric, and the heroine is retreating, in a sense, from the things both that she knows and that she doesn't know about her parents, it's very interesting to find the character's evasiveness matched by the lushness of the writer's metaphors. Was this a character who's sort of retreating and a narrator who almost has to stalk her to chart her patterns? Was that a very hard thing to work out?
you know, it's funny, I've been reading Freud on screen memories and on childhood memories and on the screen memories, the memories that come and you think that those are your memories of childhood, but in fact then those are screening your actual memories and protecting you from them. And I'm thinking a lot about that in the book I'm writing now, but I think that I tried to a two-part structure in even now in which when she's talking, when she's actually talking and she's actually acting in the real world, it's much more minimal and it's much more the way kids would talk and the way children and parents would talk. But then when you go into her mind, it sort of becomes rather baroque. And I always had the image of this, of a rug, an arabesque rug in my mind for her interior mind. And I don't know why or where I got that and why it's interesting other than all the twists and curves and things like that. And that, that's why there's that difference. And that's why you see that very marked difference. And I mean, there are passages in the book that read fairly normally. They don't seem much different from many other books, and then there are these passages that do seem to be doing, I guess, different things.
I'm talking to Michelle Adiolet, the author of Even Now, recently published by Farrar, Straus and Giroux. I found that there are many cases of narrators that are putatively odd but seem contrived to me, mm-hmm. or are extreme, but I've seen them elsewhere. This narrator, Lisa, this heroine, rather, Lisa, protagonist, seems to me to be genuinely original in her perception of the world, and this book's arrangement of perception seems unusual. The book seems to be about perception, and I think at one point one of the characters says that everything is perception. Is this a literary effect, or is this your marked oddity appearing on the page?
I think I'd just like to listen to you talk about the book, actually. It's much more interesting. I don't know. You know, you've asked me that once before, and I don't. I think in some ways I'm wary of becoming too self-conscious of whatever the book is. In some ways, because then you know, the minute they always talk about that, the minute you give a writer a Pulitzer, they're so self-conscious they never write a good book again. You know, I don't know. I know I had a very hard time writing the book, and a very hard time getting people to like it and respond to it in any way, and. I don't know. I don't. I really do not honestly know the answer to that question. I write it the way I wrote it, and I mean I worked very very hard. I don't tend to write linearly at all. I'm a frustrating writer. In fact, I mean I write four pages, and then for the next 3 days I work in the middle of one of those paragraphs. So the work never ever progresses in a linear way. So that might have something to do with the type of oddness to the construction. Part of the
mystery is that Lisa's parents, Elizabeth and...
Neville.
I
just forgot myself.
Have parted under mysterious circumstances. What? And gradually we come to hear that once he is gone, Elizabeth keeps a gun in bed with her, mm-hmm. Fears that he will re-enter the house, and in fact believing that her daughter has not lost her key but given it to her father, mm-hmm. Elizabeth doesn't give her daughter a key to their own house. She does her homework in the barn. At one point, she needs to break in and hurts her wrist in breaking a window. There's a very strange way in which this oddness is presented in a casual fashion. Mm-hmm. And in fact, friends, her mother's new lover, her stepfather, tell Lisa that she does not know the effect that her mother is having on her. That's, I guess, what I'm getting at there, the decision to have a very odd tone narrative related as if complacently.
Okay. I understand. What I was trying to do there was, it seems to me, I mean, growing up, you grow up and you're in your family the way, you know no other way of being in your family than the way things happen.
Uh-huh.
And so you don't tend to look at it with any distance or any objectivity at all. I mean, what goes on in your family is completely normal to you, probably. You know, it seems completely normal until you've been out in the world enough to be able to look at it and say, ooh, that was vicious. You know, you don't realize it's vicious. I mean, I moved 14 times in my childhood and never thought anything of it. I mean, you just, oh, it's time to pack my toys again, you know. never thought that might be odd, you know. And so I was trying to capture that feeling of, or maybe it's even a lack of feeling or a lack of sense of that there's anything wrong here. But that sometimes people looking in can see that there is definitely something wrong there.
I guess also the reason why I found myself wondering, you know, does it extend beyond the characters in this narrative to its author, is that the mother, Elizabeth, has a very unusual way of looking at language as a kind of harvest ground for what she calls life's little surprises. I wonder if you would tell about the little speculation that the mother and daughter have in the car when they're looking for the street Pinehurst.
Yeah. That is less of an interesting sort of deconstructionist play than I think people are trying to make it. I was merely playing with how language in a family is completely loaded. It's a loaded gun always, you know, and that you can be at the family table with friends of yours and then their whole family's around and somebody can say something and because you're the outsider, you don't pick it up at all, right? But all of a sudden your friend next to you is bristling to beat the band, you know, it's because you don't understand the language. You don't understand what's going on in the family. And I think that the mother's play with language. She likes to play word games, but Lisa knows that all of those games are laden with implication and an emotional implication and damaging implications. And the Pinehurst thing, I mean, it was just, you know, mother makes a game of it, you know.
They're looking for Pinehurst Street, and she
begins
by asking her if she notices the word hearse in Pinehurst, and then whether she knows that coffins are made of pine. And then the daughter chips in when asked to spell hearse, H-E-A-R-S-E, mentions that there's a here in hearse and the beginning of see. And isn't this odd because people in a coffin can neither hear nor see? And by this point, you know, you're aware that the language in the book, as used by the characters, is going to be full of morbid connotation.
Yeah. Yes, I guess it is. I don't know. You never know to respond to that. I mean, go back to your question about the gun and the that sort of nascent threat that's always in the background. That's always what I was playing with, you know. I tried to capture that the vigilance in the character of Lisa, but I think that most children have of always watching very carefully, because everything is new to them and everything's loaded too, and so the stuff about dead wood, you know, is there's going to be a lot of killing, you know, but it doesn't have anything to do with car chases and guns and killing and stuff like that. It has to do with those little bits of emotion that get stomped on.
What Elizabeth Bowen calls the death of the heart.
Right, exactly. Yeah, that's a beautiful book. It's one of my favorite books.
One of my favorite books.
Oh, yeah, it's just a stunning book. That's interesting. There's one of my favorite passages in that book is of the housekeeper polishing the wood, in fact, the wooden furniture, which is just this stunning, stunning passage about what the wood is and why the wood is polished and what it means to polish.
Well, I was going to ask you, this particular girl, speaking of wood textures, Lisa in this narrative, at one point sees one woman's hair as like highly polished wood of many different colors and loses herself in a kind of microscopic possibility. Another woman's hair strikes her as being like chocolate cake. There's the most extraordinary coiffure in the course of this book. I don't even know if you need to say anything about
good.
It.
That's what I said. I'd much rather just listen to you talk about the book. It's much more interesting.
This was written, was it, in the course of the workshop at Irvine?
Yeah, 2 years of the workshop, and then 2 years after that. Yeah.
What is that process like? What, literally, you bring in a chapter and...
This book is, there's no chapters in this book, and there are no breaks in this book, which was another thing that made it very hard to bring it into workshop, because I wanted the book completely all of a wash. It's about something that doesn't end, never ends, right? Even now, and so I wanted the book that way. And so it was very hard to present it to the workshop, and it was not received very well either, you know. But that's because they didn't have the whole thing in front of them, you know. That's a difficult process, just being in the workshop, even if you're handing them stuff that they love. It's a hard process, you know. But you learn a lot. I'm not sure I really started writing the book that you've got in front of you until I got out of the workshop. Because they have all of those voices. I mean, you know, I start out being self-conscious, horribly self-conscious, and then you give me 14 readers, and the self-consciousness gets a little dense, you know. So I didn't start writing until I was out of the workshop, really. So,
do many people, I'm sure that a lot of listeners have heard a lot about writing workshops, and we'll be talking about a workshop I'll be visiting in upcoming weeks. But what is that experience like? Do most people write their books in, you know,
in sort of a community?
Yeah.
I don't know. You know, I somebody just invited me to join a women's group that are all writing a novel together. You know, and I sort of balked. I mean, I didn't know what to think of such a thing. You know, I don't know. I can't write in community, but I certainly you have to have readers, and you have to have readers who know what you're up to, and also readers who don't know what you're up to, and can tell you where, you know, they get it or they don't get it, you know. So I think it's very, very important to have a community around you, but I don't know about writing. Writing to me is done in a room alone with the world shut out and as much as possible. So I don't know about that, you know. I think the workshops, those are readers, and that you have to learn how readers read, or good readers, and not all workshop members are good readers, and that's a problem. You have to sort those out, or they're lazy readers, and so, you know, unfortunately, workshops are sometimes composed of those types of readers, and they're not good.
Are writers in general good readers of each other's work?
It just depends, you know. I have good readers, two or three people that are close to me who are very, very good readers for me, and then I have a lot of writer friends who are not good readers for me at all. But I would say they're probably good readers, you know. You know, I don't know.
I'm speaking to Michelle Letellier, the author of Even Now, a book recently published by Farrar, Straus and Giroux. I wanted to ask a final question: is there a play on words in the title?
I've never ever thought about that until that moment. I mean, I just think of what the play could be.
Well, the sense that she is even now.
Right, yeah. No, I get it. That somehow, finally, there's been retribution. No, and I, I tried to pull as far back from anger and from parent bashing and from pot shots in this book as I possibly could, because that's not what I wanted to write about at all. No, she's not even, and she'll never be even, but nor is this a war. It's pretty much life.
Well, you see, with so much dread running through the book, and there is the feeling as you go along that there will be a shock in the final stages of the narrative, that you begin, because the heroine Lisa is so, in a way, hurt by different forces in her life, you do almost want her to be even, mm-hmm. or have some moment. So in some sense, the title became, for me, a desired destiny,
right?
Paradise Now.
You're right. Well, you do want her to finally make some sort of assertive move, somehow say, for her to somehow take her life into her own hands, finally, you know. And you know, it's interesting. I mean, the different reactions to the mother. Some people think that they just hate her. You know, they just can't stand this woman. And then other people say, oh no, you know, I really understand. You know, I feel sorry for her. You know, and all that she has to deal with.
The father, the pilot, is every bit as scary.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah. Jonathan Galassi, you know.
your editor.
Oh, yeah, yeah. He's, you know, that father, you know, he thinks he's dim-witted, you know.
The only person I found sort of unequivocally likable was Mary, the botanist, who in her scientific aspect is a little bit scary, too.
Yeah. With the vegetables and trying to marry two different types of vegetables and things like that.
And the talk in the book about two-headed lambs, all these sort of eugenic experiments, and all the images of creatures who are being preyed upon by parasites, so that even the friendlier images seem to have contained within them a lurking malevolent edge.
Yeah.
Well, thank you for being with us, Michelle Ladiolet. I look forward to talking to you more in the future. I'm Michael Silverblatt. My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The engineer today is Eric Myers. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books. To the land of vices, go in books.
As you ramble through the pages, books will take you through the ages, back to days of old when knights were bold, and books,
books, books, books, books, books. Books can be funny too.
Books make you laugh and sing. Books tell you everything. They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme.
Now with book of the mouse, pop.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.